was not a new idea, but hadn't come up in any serious fashion since June 20, 1973, when Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Guarantee, and the British Morgan Grenfell held a top-secret meeting in Bermuda, codenamed Triangle, at the Grotto Bay Hotel. On a whiteboard, Diamond used a black marker to sketch out what he had been thinking. "We can either buy them, buy part of them, or give them some type of financing." For the next 2 hours, they went around in circles, considering their options. What parts of Morgan Stanley could be spun off? What parts could be warehoused? The term for buying a property, keeping it relatively intact, if not in fact making it healthier, and then selling it later, when the market recovered. Maybe they could buy Morgan Stanley, Diamond suggested aloud, and then create a new tracking stock for it. But all these scenarios wound up circling back to the same problem. What exactly would they be buying? The overlap between the firms was enormous. And what were Morgan Stanley's toxic assets really worth? These were all but unanswerable questions at that time. John Hogan, J.P. Morgan's chief risk officer, who had attended the meeting with Lehman Brothers the previous week, stepped out of the operating committee conference room and called Combe Kelleher and Ken Direct at Morgan Stanley. "I don't know exactly what you guys have in mind, but under any scenario where we help you, we're going to need a bunch of information," he said. "Could you go back and talk to Mac and find out exactly what it is that you're expecting, that you'd like from us in terms of this help?" There was more than a little condescension in Hogan's voice, and Kelleher and Direct picked up on it immediately. A half hour later, Kelleher got back to Hogan with an outline for a request for a $50 billion line of credit. Kelleher was hoping that if J.P. Morgan did come through with an offer, Diamond would not be as punitive as CIC had been. Hogan sent an email to J.P. Morgan's senior team with the subject line, "Urgent and Confidential." In it, he spelled out the plan. "Please plan to meet at Morgan Stanley's offices at 750 7th Avenue tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. We don't have the floor or room as yet. MS contact person is David Wong. The purpose of the meeting is for us to consider entering into a secured financing against a variety of different unencumbered assets at MS." Geithner was by now seriously miffed. He had been trying to reach Pandit since 8 in the morning, and had just heard back from Blankfein, who had somehow actually managed to get through to Pandit again. The only problem was that Pandit had turned Goldman down, and Geithner hadn't even had a chance to speak with him. Finally, he got through to him. "I haven't been able to reach you for 4 hours," Geithner barked into the phone. "That's unacceptable on a day like today." Apologizing, Pandit explained that he had been talking to his team about the Goldman proposal, which they had ultimately rejected. "We're concerned about taking on Goldman," Pandit said, trying to explain his rationale for turning them down. "I don't need another $1 trillion on my balance sheet." Geithner could only laugh to himself. "This is a bank," Pandit said, "and a bank takes deposits, and a bank has a prudency culture. I cannot envision a bank taking its deposits and investing them all in hedge funds. I know that's not what Goldman is, but the perception is that they'd be taking deposits and putting them to work against a proprietary trade. That can't be right philosophically." Having dispensed with pushing Goldman and Citigroup together, Geithner moved on to his next idea, merging Morgan Stanley and Citigroup. Pandit had been considering that option too, and while he was more predisposed to merging with Morgan Stanley, he still was reluctant. "It's still not our choice to do this deal, but we could think about it," he told Geithner. By 2 o'clock p.m., John Mack was growing concerned that the talks with CIC were going nowhere. Gao hadn't budged on what Mack was calling an offensive offer. He had no idea what Jamie Dimon would come up with, and he hadn't heard anything from Mitsubishi. Downstairs, Paul Taubman, the firm's head of investment banking, was experiencing much the same panic as Mack. A disarmingly young-looking 48-year-old, Taubman had worked his entire career at Morgan Stanley, rising to become one of the most trusted merger advisors in the nation, and could now only wonder if it was all going to come to an end this weekend. Taubman and his colleague, Jinyun Lee, were on the phone to Tokyo, where it was past midnight, with Kohayuki, his Morgan Stanley counterpart, who was trying to coordinate talks with Mitsubishi. "I think they've gone to bed for the night. We'll pick it up in the morning," Yuki said. That's not going to work, Taubman answered. You need to call them at home and wake them up. There was a long pause. This was certainly a breach of Japanese protocol.
Okay, he said.
Listen, if you're a senior executive, you're not going to say, you know what, I'm not going to wake my boss, and I'll just keep it to myself, and then if it turns out that I missed the opportunity of a lifetime, how am I going to explain it to him if he wasn't awakened? 20 minutes later, Yuki was back on the phone with Taubman. I got him. Mitsubishi was going to wake up its entire deal team and get working. In a conference room just 2 floors down, Morgan Stanley's board had arrived, and things had grown tense quickly. Some had flown across the country to get there. Others, like Sir Howard J. Davies, had flown in from London. The only person missing was Charles E. Phillips, president of the software giant Oracle and a former Morgan Stanley technology analyst. Kelleher had just finished giving a presentation on the firm's finances, and it was not good. Charles Noski, a director and former chief financial officer of AT&T, asked him point-blank, "When do we run out of money?" Kelleher paused and then said somberly, "Well, depending on what happens Monday and Tuesday, it could be as early as middle of the week." It was a shot across the bow. If this weekend didn't go well, they'd all end up the targets of shareholder lawsuits. The independent board members, led by the lead director, C. Robert Kidder, decided they needed to hire an independent advisor, and after a short conversation, chose Roger Altman, the former deputy treasury secretary and founder of the boutique bank Evercore Partners, and Dick Fuld's former carpool mate. He would advise the board on whatever transactions they would be presented with, and provide a modicum of cover. In the event that whatever happened over the weekend led to legal battles, at least they would look like they were trying to be responsible. After Mac came downstairs again, Jean Ludwig, Mac's outside consultant, explained the bank holding concept that they were pursuing. Ludwig said that he believed that Paulson would be motivated to protect them. "If we go, Goldman goes," he said, stating the obvious, at least internally, by that point. But then he added a new insight that the board hadn't considered. "And then GE will go." At Goldman Sachs, two of its top bankers, David Solomon and John Weinberg, had just returned from a morning meeting in Fairfield, Connecticut. They had just met with Jeffrey Immelt, General Electric's CEO, and Keith Sharon, its CFO. Seated on Cohn's couch, Solomon recounted the meeting to him. It was a complicated and almost comical situation. Solomon and Weinberg had traveled to Fairfield to advise its client on coping with the financial crisis, beginning with a plan to raise capital. One of Immelt's primary concerns, however, was what would happen if its advisor, Goldman Sachs, went out of business. General Electric was more about manufacturing than financial engineering, but roughly half of its profits in recent years had come from a finance company unit called GE Capital. Like most Wall Street firms, GE Capital relied on the short-term paper market and the confidence of investors worldwide, and Immelt was worried how the fate of Goldman and Morgan Stanley might affect it. The meeting ended without much clarity, apart from some preliminary plans to raise capital, and an assurance to Immelt that Goldman was staying in business. But Cohn was already thinking about Goldman's talks with Wachovia. Cohn, speaking to Kevin Warsh of the Fed, had agreed to entertain the idea, but only on the condition the Fed would provide assistance. Warsh had said they'd strongly consider it. Cohn believed him. Paulson had spoken with Blankfein and told him to take the talks seriously. "If you go into this looking for all the problems and how much help you're going to get, it's never going to happen," he said, adding, "You're in trouble, and I can't help you." In the meantime, Warsh instructed Cohn to make sure they could work out the personal dynamics. "Let's not waste our time on economics if you guys are never going to solve the social issues," he said. "If you aren't willing to accommodate them, if Bob's not willing to do whatever, this isn't going to happen." Steele was scheduled to land at Westchester County Airport in White Plains, a suburb of the city, in only a few hours, and Cohn walked into Blankfein's office and made a suggestion. "Lloyd, you should go pick Steele up at the airport," Cohn said, believing it would be a gracious gesture to kick off the merger talks. Blankfein looked seriously annoyed, having never felt that he got along with Steele particularly well ever since Paulson had made them co-heads of the equities division years earlier.
Do I have to?
Yes, Kohn said firmly. I would go with you, but it would be awkward. You should go pick him up.
Blankfein was still resistant.
Can you go by yourself?
No, said Kohn,
who considered Steele a friend.
I already have a very good relationship with him.
Blankfein relented. He'd head to the airport. For a moment, Paulson felt he could breathe a sigh of relief. His team had finished the first draft of the TARP legislation and gotten a quick sign-off from the Office of Management and Budget to begin distributing it on the Hill. Given that he had promised the congressional leadership on Thursday night that he could get them something to work on in hours, he figured he'd make it succinct. Paulson, Kevin Frommer, his head of legislative affairs, and Bob Hoyt, his general counsel, had rushed to draft it, and it came in at just under 3 pages. After much debate, Paulson's team settled on the $700 billion figure that Kashkari had proposed the day before. If passed, it would be the largest one-time expenditure in the history of the federal government. Concerned about the potential for political interference, Hoyt had slipped several lines into the bill aimed at preventing it, as well as granting Paulson whatever powers he might need. Decisions by the Secretary pursuant to the authority of this act are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion, and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency. The Secretary is authorized to take such actions as the Secretary deems necessary to carry out the authorities in this act, without regard to any other provision of law regarding public contracts. Any funds expended for actions authorized by this act, including the payment of administrative expenses, shall be deemed appropriated at the time of such expenditure. It might have been too early to expect any feedback, but Treasury staffers were already excitedly forwarding copies to one another. And the reaction was instant. Even inside the department, there were worries that Paulson might look like he was overreaching. The 3-page bill had no oversight plan and virtually no qualifiers. Its terse length alone was making people uneasy.
"So, have you seen the bill?" Dan Jester asked Jeremiah Norton, neither of whom had worked on the proposal.
"I've seen the talking points," Norton replied.
"No," said Jester. "That is the bill."
Late Saturday afternoon, Combe Kelleher and Morgan Stanley's deputy treasurer, Dave Russo, headed down to the NY Fed with their advisors, Ed Herlihy of Wachtell and Promontory's Gene Ludwig, to present their application for bank holding company status. In the 13th floor reception area, two staffers approached them and asked, "Which of you is the CFO?"
"I am," Kelleher said.
"You need to come with us by yourself." Kelleher mockingly bade farewell to his colleagues as he was escorted to a conference room where the New York Fed's top leadership, William Rutledge, Bill Dudley, Terry Chetke, and Christine M. Cumming, were assembled.
"Look," Rutledge said, "if all else fails this weekend, will you agree to become a bank holding company?"
"What does that mean?" Kelleher asked, still somewhat unsure of the technicalities. The benefits of a bank holding company were explained to him. Short-term financing would be available through the Fed's discount window, provided Morgan Stanley established a sufficient deposit base and submitted to various regulations.
"Will you get your board to agree?" they asked Kelleher.
Kelleher now understood what this meeting meant. The Federal Reserve might be offering to save his firm. The tank might not reach empty after all.
"Of course," he replied.
Lloyd Blankfein, wearing slacks and a button-down shirt, was waiting in the Westchester County Airport parking lot when Bob Steele arrived. Always perfectly coiffed, Steele nonetheless looked as if he could use some sleep as he walked out of the terminal. He had already been awake for 15 hours, and his day was hardly done.
"What a birthday present," Blankfein said to Steele brightly when he saw him.
Blankfein, who turned 54 that day, was still hoping to get to a birthday dinner later that evening at Porterhouse, New York, a steak restaurant, with his wife, Laura. As they drove into the city, they delicately began discussing the outlines of a deal and discussing their history together. Neither of them knew what to make of the merger idea, or, for that matter, each other. When they reached 85 Broad Street, Steele went directly to the 30th floor, where he used to spend a lot of his time. As he stepped into the conference room, he saw Chris Cole, who had been his firm's advisor for the past 5 months.
Now, Cole would be on the other side, trying to buy Wachovia. Meanwhile, Steele's own lawyer, Rajan Cohen, was also Goldman's lawyer. It had all become so confusing and rife with conflicts, but they all agreed that if they were going to do a deal, they'd have to reach an agreement by Monday morning. Goldman's biggest issue was, as it had been with Morgan Stanley, trying to determine the scope of the whole. Wachovia owned $122 billion of pay option arms, which Goldman Sachs quickly felt wasn't going to be worth much. They each agreed to put teams on it to work up the numbers. Steele said he'd have his group fly up by morning. Before decamping for the night, Blankfein invited Steele back to his office. He wanted to talk about titles, perhaps the most sensitive issue for men who often measure themselves as much by their business cards as by their wallets. Blankfein said he was thinking of making Steele one of three co-presidents, along with Gary Cohn and John Winkelried. Steele would continue to manage Wachovia as the consumer arm of Goldman Sachs. Steele was taken aback and slightly offended. He was already the CEO of a major bank. He'd been a vice chairman of Goldman and a deputy treasury secretary in Washington. And now he was being asked to become one of three co-presidents? "I'm not sure I want to be at the same level with Gary and John," he said diplomatically. "But we'll figure this out." "Is Jamie trying to buy us?" Gary Lynch, Morgan's general counsel, asked Mac in the corridor outside his office. "I don't think so," Mac said, explaining that they were simply negotiating with J.P. Morgan to extend a credit line to the firm. "Why do you ask?"
"Well, something strange is going on then," Lynch replied.
Lynch related that an outside lawyer for Morgan Stanley's independent board members, Faiza J. Saeed, a partner with Kravath, had just informed him that J.P. Morgan had called a Kravath colleague seeking to hire her to work on a deal for Morgan Stanley. She had been a little vague, but she wanted him to clear the conflict, Lynch explained.
"Wow," Max said.
"Yeah, this is a nice way of sending a message." As dusk was setting, Hank Paulson was still in his office and had just gotten off the phone with Geithner. The news was not promising. Geithner told him that Morgan Stanley had no plan apart from what he called the naked bank holding company scenario. Geithner said he was uncertain whether any investor, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, the Chinese, or the Japanese, would come through, and he was skeptical of the Goldman-Wachovia deal.
"We're running out of options," he told Paulson.
Paulson, who had been living on barely 3 hours of sleep a night for a week, was beginning to feel nauseated. Watching the financial industry crumble in front of his eyes, the world he had inhabited his entire career was getting to him. For a moment, he felt lightheaded. From outside his office, his staff could hear him vomit. Saturday night, John Mack returned to his Upper East Side apartment, still nursing a persistent cold he couldn't shake. His wife, Christy, who had driven into the city from Rye to console him, was waiting up. He was quieter than usual, wondering yet again how he would manage to raise billions of dollars in capital in only 24 hours. "You know, there's a chance I could lose the firm," he said, a sense of despair in his voice. He needed some air, he told Christy, and decided to go on a walk. As he roamed up Madison Avenue, he realized that his entire adult life, his entire professional career, was on the line. He had been in battles before. His losing fight with the firm's former CEO, Philip J. Purcell, had been a notable one, but never anything like what he faced now. But this was not just about his personal survival. It was about the 50,000 people around the globe who worked for him, and for whom he felt a keen sense of responsibility. Images of Lehman employees streaming out of their building the previous Sunday night carrying boxes of their possessions still haunted him. He needed to buck himself up. Somehow, he was going to save Morgan Stanley. When he stepped into his living room a few minutes later, he admitted to Christy with a grateful smile, "I'd rather be doing this than reading a book in North Carolina." Even before the black Suburban had come to a stop in his driveway on Saturday evening, Hank Paulson was stepping out the door, his razor at his ear. His Secret Service agent, Jim Langan, preferred that Paulson wait inside until Langan got out of the vehicle, but Paulson had long since abandoned such protocol. Paulson raced inside to get on a call with Vice Premier Wang Qishan in China. For the past day, he had been trying to coordinate the call to press his case for China to pursue an investment in Morgan Stanley. Originally, he had wanted President Bush to call China's president and had spoken with Josh Bolton, the president's chief of staff, about it. But Bolton had concerns about whether it was appropriate for the president to be calling on behalf of a specific U.S. company. He suggested that, at best, the president might be able to call and speak broadly about the financial industry, finding a subtle way to be encouraging. But before such a call could be made, Paulson needed to size up China's true interest. Paulson had scheduled the call with Wang for 9:30 p.m. He knew Wang well from his trips to China as the CEO of Goldman, and they had a comfortable rapport. He also knew it was highly unusual to be orchestrating a private market deal with another country, in this case, the largest holder of U.S. debt. Before placing the call, Paulson had reached out to Stephen Hadley, assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, to get some guidance. The instructions, tread carefully. When Paulson was finally connected to Wang, he moved quickly to the topic at hand, Morgan Stanley. "We'd welcome your investment," Paulson told Wang. He also suggested that one of China's biggest banks, like ICBC, should participate, making the investment a strategic one. Wang, however, expressed his anxiety about CIC becoming involved with Morgan Stanley, given what had happened to Lehman Brothers. "Morgan Stanley is strategically important," Paulson said, suggesting he would not let it fail. Wang remained unimpressed, asking for a commitment that the U.S. government would guarantee any investment. Paulson, trying to avoid making an explicit promise, but also trying to assuage him, said, "I can assure you that an investment in Morgan Stanley would be viewed positively." Only a few hours later, Sunday morning, Paulson was back in the Suburban, where Michelle Davis, his communications chief, was waiting. "You're not going to like this," she said as she pulled out a copy of the cover of the new Newsweek, which would appear on newsstands on Monday. Under the headline, "King Henry," was a photograph of Paulson. They were headed to an early taping of NBC's Meet the Press to sell his TARP proposal with his fishing buddy, Tom Brokaw, who had temporarily taken over hosting responsibilities for the political talk show after Tim Russert died. From there, they would head to ABC's This Week, and then to CBS's Face the Nation. Paulson skimmed through the article. It was a flattering profile, with the exception of a quote from Governor John Corzine, his old nemesis from Goldman, questioning his consistency. But more important, the cover was a tacit acknowledgement of the enormous power that Paulson now wielded, not only in America, but on the world stage. President Bush had taken a back seat. Paulson had become the de facto leader of the country in this time of crisis. The power pleased him, but he also knew that it cut both ways. He discovered just how far it cut within minutes of the red lights going on for the Brokaw interview, when the host lit into him about the lack of details in the TARP plan, the same lack of details that Treasury staffers had privately worried about the day before. "If you were in your old job as chairman of Goldman Sachs, and you took this deal to the partners," Brokaw said, "they'd send you out of the room and say, 'Come back when you've got a lot more answers,' wouldn't they?" Kenneth Direct, Morgan Stanley's chief risk officer, was trying to put the best face on his firm's finances as he prepared for the meeting with J.P. Morgan that morning, assembling lists of collateral that he hoped would be considered strong enough to lend against. But as he worked, it began to dawn on both him and Ruth Porat, who ran the firm's financial institutions group, that an unrestricted show-and-tell session with J.P. Morgan bankers might be counterproductive. If all went well, Morgan Stanley would become a bank holding company that very evening, a plan that J.P. Morgan was unaware of, giving it access to far more liquidity. So they decided to be selective about what they would and wouldn't feature in the presentation, and included only the bank's collateral that they wouldn't be able to pledge to the Fed, which represented some of the worst holdings on its books. It would be a risky move. Rather than burnishing the firm for a sale, they could unknowingly scare off a potential partner.
Bronstein, Hogan, and Black of J.P. Morgan arrived at 750 7th Avenue punctually at 8:45 a.m., bringing the firm's general counsel, Stephen Cutler, with them. Several dozen underlings had already arrived and were waiting. The location, a nondescript office building with no signage a block west of Morgan Stanley's headquarters, was where the company typically held any meeting it wanted kept secret. "This is highly confidential," Hogan reiterated to the team as they set up in a meeting room that Morgan Stanley had provided. Bronstein was surprised that no coffee or food was provided for his team. "Is this some kind of negotiating tactic?" And immediately sent an associate to Dunkin' Donuts. They all knew they were there for what could be the most historic diligence session of their lives. While Hogan had told them the meeting was about extending a line of credit to Morgan Stanley, they all knew that it could quickly turn into a full-blown merger, a transaction that would make the Bear Stearns deal look like Little League practice. War rooms were set up to review each major part of Morgan Stanley's business: prime brokerage, real estate, principal investments, and commodities. J.P. Morgan's lawyers had expressed serious doubts to the team that they could pull off a deal like this in such a short compass of time. They kept referring to the problem of perfecting security interests in less than 24 hours. In fact, it wouldn't take nearly that long. Within 2 hours, J.P. Morgan decided to pull the plug. They were shocked that the assets that Morgan Stanley was offering as collateral were of such low quality, surely too low for J.P. Morgan to lend against. "This stuff is crap," Hogan told Steve Black, J.P. Morgan's president. By midday, Goldman Sachs and Wachovia, which was represented by a half-dozen executives whom Bob Steele had brought along, were making rapid progress toward completing a deal. Peter Weinberg, Bob Steele's advisor and a former Goldman man, had constructed the outlines of an agreement in which Goldman would pay $18.75 a share for Wachovia's shares in Goldman stock. The price represented the closing price of Wachovia's shares on Friday. There remained, however, one serious obstacle. Goldman wanted a Jamie deal. The next step was to go back to Warsh at the Fed and ask whether the Fed was prepared to subsidize the deal by guaranteeing Wachovia's most toxic assets. During a lull in the negotiations, Weinberg took a break and walked down the hall of the executive floor. As he passed a series of portraits of the firm's past chief executives, he stopped when he reached Sidney Weinberg, his grandfather. Sidney Weinberg, who became a Goldman partner in 1927, represented the epitome of the old Wall Street, a business that had been defined by personal relationships and implicit trust, not leverage and ever more complicated financial engineering. His grandfather's world had been obliterated over the past decade as firms sought to go public and began using shareholder money to place what had proved to be dangerously risky bets. John Winkelried, Goldman's co-president, was passing down the hall when he saw Weinberg gazing thoughtfully at the portrait. "The world has really been turned on its head," Winkelried said wistfully. Warren Buffett was at his home in Omaha on Sunday when he received a phone call from Byron Trott, a vice chairman at Goldman Sachs. Buffett, who disliked most Wall Street bankers, adored Trott, a mild-mannered Midwesterner based in Chicago. Paulson had introduced the men years earlier, and Trott was now the only investment banker Buffett truly trusted. "He understands Berkshire far better than any investment banker with whom we have talked, and, it hurts me to say this, earns his fee," Buffett wrote in Berkshire Hathaway's 2003 annual report. For Buffett, there is no more lavish praise. Trott was calling Buffett with a proposition. For the past several weeks, he had been trying in vain to persuade Buffett to make an investment in Goldman, but he had now come up with a new idea. He disclosed to Buffett that Goldman was in talks to buy Wachovia, with government assistance, and wanted to know whether Buffett might be interested in investing in a combined Goldman-Wachovia. At first, Buffett wasn't sure he was hearing Trott correctly. Government assistance in a Goldman deal? "Byron, it's a waste of time," he said in his folksy way after considering the new configuration. "By tonight, the government will realize they can't provide capital to a deal that's being done by the firm of the former Treasury Secretary with the company of a retired vice chairman of Goldman Sachs and former Deputy Treasury Secretary. There is no way."
They'll all wake up and realize, even if it was the best deal in the world, they can't do it.
John Mack had received some promising news Sunday afternoon. Mitsubishi looked like it would actually pull through and make a sizable investment in Morgan Stanley. A conference call had been arranged for Mack to speak with Mitsubishi's chief executive, Nobuo Kuroyanagi, that evening. Just as they were going over the details, however, Paulson called.
"John, you have to do something," Paulson said sternly.
"What do you mean, I have to do something?" Mack asked, his voice rising with impatience, explaining that he had just learned that the Japanese were inclined to do the deal.
"You've been so supportive. You said we can get through this."
"I know," Paulson said, "but you've got to find a partner."
"I have the Japanese. Mitsubishi is going to come in," he repeated, as if Paulson hadn't heard him the first time around.
"Come on, you and I know the Japanese. They're not going to do that. They'll never move that quickly," Paulson said, suggesting that he focus more on the deal with the Chinese or J.P. Morgan.
"No, I do know them, and I know I don't agree with you," Mack answered angrily.
He explained that Mitsubishi had had a long-term relationship with the firm. It had used Morgan Stanley as an advisor during its hostile bid for a part of Union Bank in California earlier in the year.
"Japanese rarely do a hostile," Mack reminded him.
"They hired us. They followed through and got it done. So they'll come through for us."
Paulson was still skeptical.
"They won't do it," he said with a sigh.
"You and I disagree," Mack sputtered, agreeing to keep him updated on his progress as he hung up the phone.
Calling the Fed's Kevin Warsh out of a meeting to come to the phone, Gary Cohn outlined their preliminary Goldman-Wachovia terms for him. They had agreed to a deal at market, Friday's closing price of $18.75, and considering that Wachovia's stock had jumped 29% that day on the back of the TARP news, Cohn thought it was a generous concession. But then he wound up for his big pitch. To complete the deal, he said, Goldman would need the government to guarantee or ring-fence Wachovia's entire portfolio of ARM option mortgages, all $120 billion worth. Warsh stopped Cohn in mid-sentence.
"We're just not prepared to do that," he said.
"We can't look as if we're just writing a blank check." Warsh, who was still championing the idea of a merger, explained that they needed to think about the optics of the deal. He suggested that if they structured it so that Goldman would take a first loss on the deal, in the same way that J.P. Morgan had agreed to accept the first $1 billion of losses at Bear Stearns before the Federal Reserve would step in and guarantee the next $29 billion, the government might well consider acting as a backstop. As several of Wachovia's board members milled about a Goldman conference room, waiting to get some feedback on the deal from Steele, Joseph Neubauer, the chairman and chief executive officer of Aramark Holdings Corporation, looked down at his cell phone, which was buzzing. It was Paulson. Neubauer knew Paulson well. Goldman had been Aramark's banker, taking it public and private a handful of times and making Neubauer and the firm millions of dollars. But Neubauer felt this was a risky call. Paulson, he thought, was not supposed to involve himself with anything related to Wachovia or Goldman, and here he was phoning him in the midst of perhaps the most transformative transaction either might ever pursue. Paulson had phoned Neubauer the day before to gauge whether a deal would ever be workable. But that had just seemed like an exploratory call. Now they were in the heat of negotiations. Paulson justified making the call because he wasn't speaking directly with Steele, but Neubauer worried that, in practical terms, it seemed like a meaningless distinction.
"This is not just about Goldman Sachs," Paulson told him. "I'm concerned about Wachovia. Aren't you concerned?"
Paulson hadn't told Neubauer that he had received an ethics waiver to get involved with matters relating to Goldman. Instead, he just continued to press him to take the Goldman bid seriously, worried that Wachovia's board did not appreciate the severity of the situation in the world economy.
"I think there should be a sense of urgency," Paulson instructed him.
When Neubauer put the phone down, he looked up at the other board members.
"You're not going to believe this. That was Hank."
He didn't need to explain to the directors why the call was so surreal. To many in the room, the Treasury Secretary had just ordered them to merge with Goldman. At Treasury, Jim Wilkinson, Paulson's chief of staff, was by now practically sleepwalking down the halls.
Paulson had just updated him of the Goldman-Wachovia talks and asked him for his counsel. Should the government provide assistance? Wilkinson, in his stupor, said he thought that it sounded like a reasonable idea. But a half hour later, after a cup of coffee and further reflection, Wilkinson changed his mind. He realized that such a deal would be a public relations nightmare at the worst possible time, just as they were trying to pass TARP. Paulson would lose all credibility. He would be accused of lining the pockets of his friends at Goldman. The government, Sachs, conspiracy theories would flourish. Wilkinson ran back into Paulson's office with Michelle Davis. "Hank, if you do this, you'll get killed," Wilkinson said frantically. "It would be fucking crazy." Ben Bernanke was being piped in over the Polycom speakerphone in Geithner's conference room, where Jester and Norton from Treasury and Terry Chechki, Meg McConnell, and William Dudley from the New York Fed were gathered around a conference table. Warsh was reviewing the new terms of the Goldman-Wachovia agreement. Steele and Kahn had come back to him with a slight revision to the previous proposal, allowing for Goldman Sachs to take the first $1 billion of losses, per Warsh's suggestion. Kahn and Steele said they were committed to completing the deal that afternoon, if the government would agree to provide assistance. The boards of both companies had been put on standby. The general view in the room seemed to be that it was a good transaction. It would give Goldman a stable deposit base, at the same time it provided Wachovia with a powerful investment bank and top-notch management. But Geithner was quick to point out its drawbacks. "Does it make Goldman look weaker than they are?" he asked, the same question that Blankfein had raised earlier in the day. Geithner also wondered whether the Fed should be the one loaning the money. Since Wachovia's regulator was the FDIC, perhaps it ought to be the one to bear that burden. Chetsky couldn't believe the gall of Goldman's request. "They're still driving these negotiations as though they have leverage," he said. But he opposed the merger for a different reason. He was concerned that neither side had enough time to make a thoughtful decision, referring to the situation as the shotgun wedding syndrome. Bernanke listened to the debate without comment. Then Bill Dudley, a former Goldman man himself, who thought the deal was unattractive for the government, also raised the same objection that Buffett had raised just hours earlier. It would prove a public relations disaster for the government. "What are we doing here? Look at all of the connections you've got. Treasury and Steele and me. Goldman is everywhere. We have to be careful." After Geithner and Bernanke called Paulson, all three agreed they just couldn't support the deal. When Warsh delivered the news to Steele and Kahn, both men were flabbergasted. They had spent the last 24 hours trying to formulate an agreement at the behest of the government, and were now being told it could not be carried out. "I'm sorry, I understand. I'm just as frustrated as you are. We just don't have the money. We don't have the authorization," Warsh explained. Steele, feeling particularly slighted, told Warsh that he felt as if he were running from one bride to another, trying to find the right marriage to save his firm. First Morgan Stanley, and now Goldman Sachs. Kahn, realizing that the conversation was about to get testy, said, "I think I should step out." "No, you should listen to this," Steele insisted, raising his voice for the first time. "You should sit here and listen to every goddamn word of this." Anxiously talking into the speakerphone in the center of the table, Steele became even more irate. "What do you want me to do? Tell me what to do. You can't make this work. You don't like this, you don't like that. Do you want to do the Midtown deal?" he said, referring to Morgan Stanley. "Do you want me to call Citi? I've got to protect my shareholders. That's my job. Just tell me what the fuck you want me to do, because I'm tired of running in circles." "I don't know if it's true, but we're hearing Goldman is announcing a deal with Wachovia in the next 24 hours, John Mack announced to the management team gathered in his office. He had just learned of the rumor from a director at the meetings with his board and was distressed by the possibility. After all, it had been only Friday that they were in merger negotiations that didn't seem to be going anywhere. Taubman, the firm's head of investment banking, was horrified. How could Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley's most bitter rival, have been willing to take on all of Wachovia's toxic assets, he thought to himself. Hadn't Goldman seen the massive hole in Wachovia's balance sheet? Then it dawned on him. Those fuckers probably have a deal with the government, he exclaimed to the group. It makes no sense unless the government is bailing out Wachovia and taking back a bunch of bad assets. Paulson had gotten word that the Goldman-Wachovia deal was off, which put even more pressure on him to find a solution for Morgan Stanley. To him, J.P. Morgan was the obvious answer. While Jamie Dimon might have been resisting Paulson's overtures, Paulson had pressed the case with him several times already over the past day. Paulson now needed to apply some serious pressure. "Jamie," Paulson said when he reached him, conferencing in Geithner and Bernanke, "I need you to really think about buying Morgan Stanley. It's a great company with great assets." Dimon had just finished having an impromptu meeting with Gao of CIC, who had come to see him to explore whether J.P. Morgan would be willing to work together on a bid for Morgan Stanley, with CIC buying additional equity in the firm, and J.P. Morgan providing a credit line. But the meeting hadn't gone anywhere. Dimon, who had been anticipating that the government might try to foist the deal on him, was adamant. "You've got to stop. This is not doable," he said intently. "It's not possible. I would do anything for you and for this country, but not if it's going to jeopardize J.P. Morgan." "Even if you gave it to me, I couldn't do it," Dimon continued, explaining that he thought the deal would cost the bank $50 billion and countless job losses. "I don't want to do it, and John doesn't want to do it," Dimon told him. "Well, I might need you to do it," Paulson persisted. A few moments of silence passed until Dimon relented, but only slightly. "We'll consider it, but it's going to be tough," he said. The tension inside Morgan Stanley's board meeting was becoming untenable. Roger Altman, the banker from Evercore, who had been hired just 24 hours earlier to advise them, was telling them that they needed to think hard about selling the entire firm. He had painted a doomsday scenario, and it wasn't sitting well with several directors in the room, who had become convinced that Altman was trying to get them to do a deal simply so that he could collect a big fee. During a break, Roy Bostock approached C. Robert Kidder, the firm's lead director, and told him, "We ought to fire that guy right now. Get him out of here. He's not helping." Others were concerned that, given his close ties to the government, he was the former deputy treasury secretary and was still considered very well connected, that he was leaking information about the firm's health back to them. That, they thought, would explain why Paulson was putting so much pressure on Mac to do a deal. Though they did not know it, Altman had sent an email to Geithner the night before, telling him that he had gotten the assignment to work for Morgan, but he had not disclosed any of the details of the meeting thus far. Whether it was paranoia or just a lack of sleep, the discussion was becoming heated. Mac, who hadn't been consulted when Altman was hired, was even more upset about his being there than some of the board members. "I don't trust him," Mac announced after he kicked Altman out of the board meeting temporarily. He said he thought they should be using Morgan Stanley's own bankers to advise them if they really were going to sell the firm. He also told them he was worried about revealing the details of Morgan Stanley's negotiations with Mitsubishi in front of Altman, reminding the directors that Evercore had a partnership with Mizuho Financial Group of Japan, one of Mitsubishi's rivals. "I don't know what this guy is up to," he said. Geithner, still holding court from his office downtown, had become convinced that Morgan Stanley would fail if it didn't complete a deal by the time the markets opened on Monday. He had threatened Mac earlier in the day that he would deny his request to become a bank holding company unless he found a sizable investment or merged. "Being a naked bank holding company won't do it," he warned. Like Paulson, Geithner thought Mac was misguided in his belief that Mitsubishi would come through for them in time. "What's your plan B? You need a plan B," he had nearly screamed into the phone. Not everyone at the Fed was in agreement with Geithner's insta-merger strategy, however. So unpopular was Geithner's single-mindedness about merging banks that afternoon that some CEOs began referring to him as eHarmony, after the online dating service. "If we sell one more of these guys for a dollar," Kevin Warsh complained, "this whole freaking thing is going to come undone." At about 3:30 p.m., John Mack's assistant, Stacy Crook, announced that Secretary Paulson was on the line. Mack took the call on the phone next to his couch. The New York Giants versus the Cincinnati Bengals game was playing on the TV behind him.
Hi, John. I'm on with Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner. We want to talk to you, Paulson said.
Well, Max said, since you're all on the line, can I put my general counsel on?
Paulson agreed, and Mac hit the speakerphone button after the television was muted.
Markets can't open Monday without a resolution of Morgan Stanley, he said in the sternest way he knew. You need to find a solution. We want you to do a deal.
Mac just listened, dumbstruck.
Bernanke, who was usually remote and silent in such situations, cleared his throat and added,
You don't see what we see. We're trying to keep the system safe. We really need you to do a deal.
We've spent a lot of time working on this, and we think you need to call Jamie, Geithner insisted.
Tim, I called Jamie, Mac replied, clearly exasperated. He doesn't want the bank.
No, he'll buy it, Geithner said.
Yes, for a dollar, Mac exclaimed. That makes no sense.
We want you to do this, Geithner persisted.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think this is good public policy? Mac asked, clearly furious. There are 35,000 jobs that have been lost in this city between AIG, Lehman, Bear Stearns, and just layoffs. And you're telling me that the right thing to do is to take 45,000 to 50,000 people, put them in play, and have 20,000 jobs disappear? I don't see how that's good public policy.
For a moment, there was silence on the phone.
It's about soundness, Geithner said impassively.
Well, look, I have the utmost respect for the three of you and what you're doing, Max said. You are patriots, and no one in our country can thank you enough for that. But I won't do it. I just won't do it. I won't do it to the 45,000 people that work here.
With that, he hung up the phone. At Goldman Sachs, the mood was slightly less tense.
We're getting bank holding company, Blankfein, having just spoken with Geithner, announced as Cohn walked into his office. It's going to happen. When the Federal Reserve faxed over the draft of the press release, he could see that one other institution, which was purposely left blank, would be granted the same status.
That must be Morgan Stanley, he thought.
His Friday morning call to Mac must have worked. Cohn, sitting down on Blankfein's couch, picked at an omelet, having not touched food all day. He could finally smile. They were finally out of the woods. Now, all they needed to do was have the directors sign off on the execution of the application. They had set up a conference call with the entire board to start in 5 minutes. When everyone was assembled online, Blankfein began, I've finally got good news.
When Gao returned to Morgan Stanley late that afternoon, he learned that the firm was engaged in merger talks with Mitsubishi. He had thought something was amiss earlier, because Mac had slowed down the negotiations, but he couldn't believe Mac was about to do a deal with the Japanese. He thought the U.S. government had already blessed an agreement with CIC, based on Paulson's conversation with Vice Premier Wang Qishan the night before. Furious, he pulled his entire team from the conference room and marched out of the building without even saying goodbye. The Morgan Stanley bankers were still waiting to find out if the Mitsubishi deal was a go. The Fed, they had learned, was going to grant them bank holding company status, but Geithner was still insisting the firm needed a big investment by Monday as a show of confidence in the company. Mitsubishi had sent over a proposal, a letter of intent, to buy up to 20% of the firm for as much as $9 billion. But Taubman and Kindler knew that all they were getting was a letter. It wouldn't be an ironclad contract, as they couldn't get a full deal turned around quickly enough. But they were just hoping investors in the market would take the Japanese at their word and have more faith in them than Paulson or Geithner had. As Kindler and Taubman were reviewing the letter, they laughed at all the news coverage about their weekend of whirlwind merger talks. Various media outlets had the news backward or were reporting old rumors. Gasparino declared on television that Morgan Stanley was about to do a deal with either Wachovia or CIC. The most fucking dangerous man on Wall Street, Kindler sighed. Upstairs, Mac was on the phone with Mitsubishi's chief executive, Nobuo Kuroyanagi, and a translator, trying to nail down the letter of intent. His assistant interrupted him, whispering, Tim Geithner is on the phone. He has to talk to you. Cupping the receiver, he said, Tell him I can't speak now. I'll call him back. 5 minutes later, Paulson called.
I can't. I'm on with the Japanese. I'll call him when I'm off, he told his assistant. 2 minutes later, Geithner was back on the line. He says he has to talk to you and it's important, Mac's assistant reported helplessly. Mac was minutes away from reaching an agreement. He looked at Ji-Yun Lee, a young banker who was standing in his office helping with the deal, and told her, cover your ears.
Tell him to get fucked, Mac said of Geithner. I'm trying to save my firm.
Thank God we're out, Jamie Dimon exclaimed as he ran across J.P. Morgan's executive floor into Jimmy Lee's office, where the management team had camped out, waiting for their next orders as they bided their time watching the Ryder Cup and the New York Giants game, chowing down on steaks from the palm. Mac just called, Dimon said, breathing a sigh of relief. They got $10 billion from the Japanese. At 9:30 p.m., the news hit the wires. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley would become bank holding companies. It was a watershed event. The two biggest investment banks in the nation had essentially declared their business model dead to save themselves. The New York Times described it as a move that fundamentally reshapes an era of high finance that defined the modern Gilded Age, and a blunt acknowledgement that their model of finance and investing had become too risky. Chapter 19. On Monday, September 22nd, the day after Goldman Sachs became a bank holding company, Lloyd Blankfein, his face puffy with exhaustion, sat staring at a framed cartoon from Gary Larson's The Far Side on his office end table. The drawing features a father and son standing in their suburban front yard and gazing over a fence at their neighbor's house, where a line of wolves is in the process of entering the front door. I know you miss the Wainwrights, Bobby, the caption reads, but they were weak and stupid people, and that's why we have wolves and other large predators. To Blankfein, that pretty much summed up what had just happened to Wall Street. Had things worked out slightly different, Morgan Stanley, and perhaps even Goldman Sachs, could have ended up just like the Wainwrights. Of the big five investment banks, his own and Morgan Stanley were the last ones standing. But Goldman's footing seemed increasingly unsteady. As the day wore on, Goldman's stock price, unlike Morgan Stanley's, was not stabilizing but continuing to plunge, falling 6.9%. Despite its having been designated a bank holding company, giving it virtually unlimited access to liquidity from the Federal Reserve, investors had suddenly become worried about whether Goldman would need more capital. After rising for 2 days the week before on hopes that TARP would save the economy, the broader market also was now moving again in the wrong direction. As investors had begun digesting the plan, they had come to realize that Paulson was going to have to do a better job of selling it if it was, as he intended, to renew confidence in the economy. To many Americans who had suffered substantial losses in their 401k plans, Wall Street simply didn't deserve to be saved. It would be a grave mistake to say that we're going to buy up a bad debt that resulted from the bad decisions of these people and then allow them to get millions of dollars on the way out, Barney Frank bellowed the day before. The American people don't want that to happen, and it shouldn't happen. But the politics of the bailout was hardly a subject that was at the top of Blankfein's mind, given the more pressing concern of raising capital. He had assigned that task to John Winkelried, his co-president, who had put together a team over the weekend to reach out to potential investors in China, Japan, and the Persian Gulf. But their approach was scattershot, and they only received polite refusals from all of their potential targets. On Monday night, Byron Trott, wondering why there had been no news from New York, called Winkelried from his office in Chicago. "It's been way too quiet since the weekend. What's going on?" he asked apprehensively. Winkelried told him that they were going to begin another round of calling investors on Tuesday with a new proposal to sell shares in the firm. With the market still seesawing, he said, he didn't expect they'd be able to raise money from a single large source. Given the conditions, it would have to come in smaller amounts from dozens of institutional investors. "Hold on," Trott interrupted him. "You guys, you have to slow down here." Trott, who was the firm's closest and perhaps only conduit to Warren Buffett, suggested that they consider approaching him one more time. Since the previous Thursday, Trott had gone to Buffett with a number of different proposals to invest in Goldman,
but the ever-circumspect financier had declined them all. Blankfein had encouraged Trott to propose a standard convertible preferred deal, in which Buffett would receive preferred shares with a modest interest rate, which could be converted into common shares at about a 10% premium to Goldman's current stock price. But as Trott had correctly predicted, there wouldn't be enough upside to interest the Oracle. "In a market like this, there's no reason I can take the risk," Buffett told Trott. On Tuesday morning, after consulting with Blankfein and the rest of the senior Goldman team, Trott called Buffett again with a new proposal. Buffett's grandchildren were visiting Omaha, and as he was planning to take them to the local Dairy Queen, a chain owned by Berkshire, the conversation lasted no more than 20 minutes. Trott knew the only way Buffett would be willing to make an investment would be if he were offered an extraordinarily generous deal, which he now presented. Goldman would sell Buffett $5 billion worth of stock in the form of preferred shares that paid a 10% dividend. This meant that Goldman would be paying $500 million annually in exchange for the investment, which would also allow Buffett to convert his investment into Goldman shares at the price of $115 a share, about 8% lower than their current price. With those terms, Goldman would be paying an even greater amount than what Buffett had asked of Dick Fuld back in the spring, a sum that Fuld had seemingly rejected. Relying on his gut, as always, Buffett quickly agreed to the outlines of the deal. Trott called Winkelried, reaching him just as he emerged from the Grand Central Terminal on his way to the United Nations, where President Bush was scheduled to address the 63rd General Assembly to tell him the good news. "I think Warren will do this," Trott said excitedly. "Okay, stay where you are," Winkelried told him. Trying to find a quiet spot on the congested, noisy sidewalks outside Grand Central, Winkelried called the office to set up a conference call with Goldman's Brain Trust. David Vinier, Gary Cohn, David Solomon, and Blankfein, who had flown down to Washington for the day for meetings with lawmakers. Minutes later, the group was assembled, and they began to discuss the Buffett deal. Just as important as the infusion of cash, they agreed, was the confidence that a Buffett investment would inspire in the market. Indeed, Winkelried said, the firm would be able to raise additional money from other investors on the back of Buffett's investment. "Well, why wouldn't we do it?" Vinier wondered. "We're done," Solomon said. Trott immediately set up a call for Blankfein to speak directly with Buffett. And after the two briefly reviewed the transaction, Buffett suggested that Goldman get the papers in order and send them to him, so they could announce the deal that afternoon after the market closed. Blankfein, who always liked to review every last detail, asked, "Would you like me to just do a download for you on things that I'm concerned about?" "No, it's okay," Buffett replied calmly. "If I were worried, I wouldn't be doing this at all." With that, he rounded up his grandchildren and headed for Dairy Queen. Back at Broad Street, however, there was still one provision that troubled the group, a provision that Buffett had indicated would be a deal-breaker. Goldman's top four officers could not sell more than 10% of their Goldman shares until 2011, or until Buffett sold his own, even if they left the firm. He had explained his rationale for this condition to Blankfein by saying, "If I'm buying the horse, I'm buying the jockey, too." That stipulation would not be an issue for himself, Cohn, or Vinier, Blankfein knew, but it would be a problem for Winkelried. Only 49 years old, he had recently been making noises about leaving Goldman, and, while it was a secret within the firm, he was having his own personal liquidity crisis. Although Winkelried was debt-free, he was quickly running out of cash. Despite making $53.1 million in 2006 and about $71.5 million in 2007, most of it was in stock. In the meantime, he had been spending extraordinary sums. While he owned a 5.9-acre waterfront estate on Nantucket that he was preparing to put up for sale for $55 million, his real cash drain was Marvin Ranch, a horse farm he owned in Meeker, Colorado. Winkelried was a competitive cutter rider, and while the farm had won more than $1 million in prize money over the previous 3 years, it cost tens of millions of dollars to operate. Blankfein called him personally, and after assuring him that the firm would help him find a way out of his financial troubles, Winkelried agreed to Buffett's condition. He was unhappy with the restriction, but he knew that the Buffett deal was best for Goldman. By the next morning, Goldman had managed to sell an additional $5 billion of shares to investors on the news of the Buffett deal, and its stock rose more than 6%. Blankfein could finally relax. The wolves were no longer at the door.
"Josh, I cannot believe this is happening," Paulson shouted into his cell phone at Josh Bolton, the White House chief of staff and the man who had helped hire him. "No one checked with me on this. And if we are going to keep doing bullshit like this, you're going to need a